Speaking on this program is Brother Winford Claiborne.
Thank you very much. The resurrection of Christ was the most spectacular event in the history of the world. The enemies of Christ had temporarily silenced him by crucifying him and burying him in the new tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. They honestly believed they had forever stopped the preaching of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. But on the third day, according to the Scriptures, God raised Jesus from the dead. It simply was not possible that the Son of God could be held in death's grip. For David speaks concerning him, "I foresaw the Lord always before my face, for he is on my right hand, that I should not be moved. Therefore did my heart rejoice, and my tongue was glad. Moreover also my flesh shall rest in hope, because thou wilt not leave my soul in Hades, neither wilt thou suffer thine Holy One to see corruption. Thou hast made known to me the ways of life. Thou shalt make me full of the joy with thy countenance." Peter's argument can be summarized in this simple statement: this Jesus has God raised up, whereof we are all witnesses. Acts 2:25-27 and 32. Now a very important question. What kind of men served as witnesses to the Lord's resurrection? I make no pretense of being an expert in the law, but I shall examine in our lesson today the research of one of the greatest jurists of all time, Simon Greenleaf. Simon Greenleaf served for many years as Royale Professor of Law in Harvard Law School. Simon Greenleaf has been honored by legal experts on the same plane as they honor Sir William Blackstone of Great Britain, one of the world's greatest legal scholars. Simon Greenleaf was also a great student of the Bible. In 1874, Greenleaf wrote a very profitable book with the title, The Testimony of the Evangelist. It was originally published by James Cockcroft and Company of New York and was reprinted in 1965 by Baker Bookhouse of Grand Rapids, Michigan. Greenleaf's book lists five qualities of a good witness: their honesty, their ability, their number and the consistency of their testimony, the conformity of their testimony with experience, and the coincidence of their testimony with collateral circumstances. Page 28. I shall examine each of these characteristics of a good witness and apply them with what we know about the apostles of Jesus Christ. Television has provided the American people with some insight into what transpires in the courtrooms of our nation. We know from observation and from reading that witnesses in courts of law sometimes lie and twist the truth at the urging of their attorneys. Their motives for not telling the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, may not be easily discernible, but we know sometimes witnesses are not reliable. Some witnesses are afraid to tell the truth. That fear could arise from several different sources. If they told the truth, they might in some way be implicated in criminal activities, so they shade the truth just a little to protect themselves. Other witnesses may be afraid of the person on trial or some of his friends and supporters. All of us know that witnesses have been killed by the friends of the person being tried. This has happened many times in the world of organized crime. Occasionally, witnesses are paid to lie on the witness stand. I have no idea how often this takes place, but I am not so naive as to believe it never happens. All human beings act from some motivation. Which of the motivations I have listed led the apostles to lie about our Lord's resurrection, if indeed they did lie as they have been accused of doing? Were they afraid of being punished or even being killed if they did not tell people that Jesus had been raised from the dead? Both the Romans and the Jews were bitterly opposed to the message the apostles were preaching. The authorities would not have persecuted the apostles for denying the Lord's resurrection. The opposite would have been the case, and was the case. every time the apostles and other faithful gospel preachers taught the Lord's resurrection, their lives were in danger. If the apostles were operating from fear, they could have easily remedied that situation. They could have simply said, "We really did not see Jesus after he was raised. He said he would be raised, but we never saw him." It is significant that not one of the apostles ever said that. Most of them died with the name of our Lord Jesus Christ on their lips and in their hearts. Would they have died for a lie? Tragically, through the ages, many have died for a lie. Would sane men die for a lie when they know it to be a lie? And even the bitterest critics of the apostles have never accused the apostles of being insane. The critics have accused the apostles of being mistaken, but never of being insane. If the apostles were insane, the world has need of millions of insane people. Maybe the apostles were motivated by money when they testified that Jesus was raised from the dead. We know what a strong incentive the love of money is. Who can forget Paul's statement about the allure of wealth? "But they who will be rich fall into temptation and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, which some have coveted after. They have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows." 1 Timothy 6:9-10. It seems obvious that many televangelists are motivated by money, but no one can accuse the apostles of loving money. The apostles were poor, but probably would have been well paid by the enemies of the cross if they had turned their backs on Jesus Christ. There is hardly any doubt they could have become wealthy if they used their time and talent to refute the early Christians' claims that Jesus rose from the dead. Since the apostles were poor, just like their Lord, they needed money to live and to carry on their work. But they could not desert their Lord and his kingdom by denying the resurrection. Instead, they accused the Jews of having crucified their Lord. "You kill the Prince of Life, whom God has raised from the dead, whereof we are all witnesses." Acts 3:15. If the apostles were lying about Christ's resurrection, they could have just said, "We are preaching Christ's resurrection in order to motivate men to holy living. We never really saw Jesus after he was raised, or after some of his followers said he was raised." But they never said that because it would have been a lie. They knew he had been raised, and they were willing to risk their lives in preaching that truth. They never recanted what they had preached about the resurrection. Who in his right mind can deny the honesty of the apostles and other early gospel preachers? They literally gave their lives for what they taught about Jesus of Nazareth. If that is not honesty, I would not know how to describe it. Besides, the apostles all vigorously condemned lying, even for a worthy cause. Men and women who serve as witnesses to any event must be people of ability. Greenleaf says, "The ability of a witness to speak the truth depends on the opportunities which he has had for observing the fact, the accuracy of powers of discerning, and the faithfulness of his memory in retaining the facts once observed and known." Page 31. If the witness was not in a position to observe the event he is supposed to have seen, he cannot serve as a competent witness. If he read about the event in the newspaper or in a book, he cannot be an eyewitness. Courts of law would reject his testimony. The apostles traveled with Jesus for about 3 years. They heard his marvelous sermons. They saw his spectacular miracles. They even heard him teach about his death and resurrection. Because of their intimate association with him, there would be no mistaking who he was when he came forth from the grave. The apostles were not university graduates, but they were men of discernment. The writings of these men have for almost 2,000 years challenged the minds of some of the best scholars in the world. Simon Greenleaf wrote concerning the ability and training of two of the four gospel writers. Matthew was trained by his calling to habits of severe investigation and suspicious scrutiny, and Luke's profession demanded an exactness of observation equally close and searching. Page 32. Matthew was a tax collector, and Luke was a Greek physician. Greenleaf says concerning the other two evangelists, they were too unlearned to forge the story of their master's life, and these, that is Matthew and Luke, were too learned and acute to be deceived by any imposture. Page 32. Warren Candler's outstanding book, Christus Auctor, asks, the question then arises, is this character a myth or a historical person? Dr. Candler answers, we affirm that neither the four evangelists nor any other men of that time or of any other time could have invented this character or have constructed it out of any materials which existed then or which exist now. Page 43. Dr. Candler quotes these appropriate words from Henry Van Dyke, an outstanding American scholar and author. The result of all criticism, the final verdict of enlightened common sense, is that Christ is historical. He is such a person as men could not have imagined if they would, and would not have imagined if they could. He is neither Greek myth nor Hebrew legend. The artist capable of fashioning him did not exist, nor could he have found the materials. A non-existent Christianity did not spring out of the air and create Christ. A real Christ appeared in the world and created Christianity. Page 55. The apostles were witnesses to all the events which resulted in the establishment of God's kingdom on earth. They had the ability and the opportunity to provide what they learned about Christ for us. We have an infallible record of those events in the New Testament. God knew the need for having more than one witness. He knew that one person might be seeking revenge by testifying against a neighbor. So in his instruction to the people of Israel, the Lord demanded, at the mouth of two witnesses, or three witnesses, shall he that is worthy of death be put to death, but by the mouth of one witness he shall not be put to death. Deuteronomy 17:6. The wisdom of this arrangement must not be overlooked. It unquestionably allowed some criminals to go free, but it was necessary for a nation to protect its citizens. Simon Greenleaf says there should be a sufficient number of witnesses, and their testimony should be consistent. Page 28. He wrote, the character of their narratives is like that of all other true witnesses, containing, as Dr. Paley observes, substantial truth under circumstantial variety. There is enough of discrepancy to show that there could have been no previous concert among them, and at the same time such substantial agreement as to show that all were independent narrators of the same great transaction as the events actually occurred. Page 32. Greenleaf did not believe there were actual discrepancies or contradictions in the divine record. He offers the following reasonable observation. If these different accounts of the same transaction were in strict verbal conformity with each other, the argument against their credibility would be much stronger. All that is asked for these witnesses is that their testimony be regarded as we regard the testimony of men in the ordinary affairs of life. Page 33. Thousands and thousands of reputable scholars have been studying the gospel records for almost 2,000 years. They have generally agreed that there are apparent contradictions in the records, but most of these have been satisfactorily explained, and new light is being shed on the Bible almost every day. Liberal scholars like John Shelby Spong and Leslie Weatherhead have claimed to find many contradictions in the gospel records. But in most cases, the so-called contradictions melt away under the light of further research. I remember reading these words from V.H. Carroll, a well-known Baptist scholar. He said, as a young scholar, he found about 1,000 discrepancies in the biblical record. He had successfully resolved all of these discrepancies except 6. He said he believed he could work the 6 out if he could live long enough. The testimony of witnesses must be examined as to conformity with experience. If the apostles were testifying to ordinary events, their testimony would not have caused so much controversy. But when they say they saw a man alive after he had died and been buried, difficulties arise in the minds of many people. Men like David Hume say that miracles are impossible. So it does not matter what men say about the miracles. There are only 2 possibilities in examining the apostles' testimony. Either the men were deceived and not worthy of belief, or they were deceivers. Let us briefly examine both ideas. Were the apostles deceived about the Lord's resurrection? If they were, there were hundreds of others who were also deceived. After Paul had listed the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ, he affirmed, "And he was seen of Peter, then of the 12. After that, he was seen of above 500 brethren at one time, of whom the greater part remain unto this present, but some are fallen asleep. After that, he was seen of James, then of all the apostles. And last of all, he was seen of me also, as one born out of due time." 1 Corinthians 15, 5-8. Have you thought of the significance of the expression, "of whom the greater part remain unto this present"? Paul was saying to the Corinthian readers, if you have any doubt about the Lord's resurrection, you can travel to Galilee and interview some of the people who saw Jesus after he was raised. Not all of the witnesses were still living at the time Paul wrote 1 Corinthians, but more than half of them were. If the apostles were trying to deceive their hearers or readers, what was their motivation? If they were lying, they had everything to lose and nothing to gain. These men paid with their lives for their testimony. Would they have willingly given their lives for what they knew to be false? When those early Christians stood before an executioner, would they not have recanted their testimony if indeed they were lying? And they had to know whether they were lying or telling the truth. Must men be doubted when they testify that they have witnessed a miracle? The answer to that question involves philosophy and theology, not science. There is nothing in science which makes miracles impossible, regardless of David Hume's objections. Greenleaf listed the 5th quality of a good witness as follows: the coincidence of their testimony with collateral and contemporaneous facts and circumstances. He explained what he means. In all of this inconceivable contexture and seeming discord, there is perfect harmony. And while the fact which really happened tallies exactly with every other contemporaneous incident related to it in the remotest degree, it is not possible for the wit of man to invent a story which, if closely compared with the actual occurrences of the same time and place, may not be shown to be false. Therefore it is that variety and minuteness of detail are usually regarded as certain tests of sincerity, if the story, in the circumstances related, is of a nature capable of easy refutation if it were false. Page 43. There is more I would like to discuss with you today, but time will not allow it. But the topic I have examined with you is of utmost importance. If Jesus were raised from the dead, and the New Testament leaves no doubt about it, it is the most important fact in the universe. How could any sane man reject Jesus as God's means of saving man? On the other hand, if Jesus were not raised, Christianity is a hoax, and millions of people have been deceived into believing a lie. What hope is there for any person if Jesus were not raised from the dead? My friends, Jesus was raised from the dead and will return to receive His own. Are you in that number? If not, will you not obey the gospel today? Thank you, and may God bless you.